From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This film is about the involvement of U.S. Special Forces in the murder and disappearance of up to 3,000 Taliban prisoners who'd given themselves up under guarantee their lives would be spared. If people think Afghanistan has been liberated, then they have to be kidding themselves. The warlords are more powerful today than they've ever been, and freedom at the end of a Kalashnikov is no freedom at all.
Today, part two of our series on the controversial film Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death, which Democracy Now! Premiered nationally on Friday. We talk to award-winning filmmaker Jamie Duran about his film's explosive evidence that U.S. troops are guilty of war crimes in Afghanistan and the current state of the war-torn country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Outrage is mounting in New York following the death of Usman Zango, gunned down by police on Thursday in a scenario strikingly similar to that of Amadou Diallo. Both came to New York from West Africa in search of a better life. Both were shot dead by police. Both were unarmed. Both had no criminal record. The 43-year-old Usman Zango fixed African artifacts for a living in the Chelsea section of Manhattan. He worked in the same building where another company illegally distributed bootleg compact discs. Police raided the building on Thursday to stop the selling of the uncopyrighted recordings. Zango was working nearby when he encountered 25-year-old Officer Brian Conroy. Police said Zango approached Conroy, who was wearing plain clothes. For some reason, a chase ensued that ended when Zango ran into a dead end. Conroy then shot him 5 times. Zango suffered wounds to the abdomen, chest, upper back, and was grazed on the right arm. Conroy told officers at the scene that Zango reached for his gun, but there were no witnesses to confirm this. At a rally on Saturday, the Reverend Al Sharpton said the shooting was unjustified. He said, quote, "I don't know any unarmed man who would pick a fight with a police officer." The shooting came less than a week after the New York police mistakenly raided the Harlem apartment of Alberta Sproul and came just a few days before Alberta Sproul was buried herself. Police burst into her apartment at 6 in the morning, exploded a flash grenade, handcuffed the 57-year-old city employee. Then they realized they had the wrong apartment. She died of a heart attack a few hours later. On Saturday, Alberta Sproul was buried following a funeral that attracted over 3,000 mourners. At the funeral, Mayor Michael Bloomberg said, "As mayor, I failed to protect someone I was chosen to work with. We all failed. Humanity, an innocent human being, was taken from us, and our actions caused it." Bloomberg was praised for publicly apologizing, but many remained skeptical. Civil rights attorney Norman Siegel said, "Words are easy. Actions and changes are the real test." For the first time in its history, the Israeli government has accepted the creation of a Palestinian state. On Sunday, by one vote more than the majority needed, Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon's cabinet approved steps set out in the U.S. so-called roadmap to peace. But the Washington Post points out the Israeli cabinet avoided saying that it accepted the roadmap itself. President Bush is expected to travel to the region next month for discussions with the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers, Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas. Israeli officials said U.S. pressure played a major role in the vote. Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert told Israel Radio, "I think the document is not a good one, but we have to choose when we battle the U.S., and now is not the time." The Guardian of London reports General Sharon told his cabinet he was not happy with the roadmap, but it was, quote, "the best alternative available." Meanwhile, the BBC reports Israeli forces today blew up 2 West Bank homes, killing 7 people. The London Observer is reporting the U.S. illegally is holding up to 3,000 Iraqi prisoners of war in Iraq. In violation of the Geneva Convention, human rights officials and the Red Cross have been denied access to the captives. a French television cameraman who was wrongly arrested and briefly detained got a rare glimpse inside the prison. He said he saw hundreds of men hooded with their arms tied behind their backs. No Iraqis have yet been released from the compound. The prison camp, located near the Baghdad airport, also contains hundreds of civilians who were detained for looting. A mutiny occurred at the beginning of last week at the camp. The U.S. military officials told The Observer the U.S., quote, dealt with the rebellion. He did not confirm or deny any Iraqis were killed. First, it was Iraq, now Iran. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration appears set to call for the destabilization of the Iranian government. The Pentagon is urging President Bush to approve public and private actions that could lead to the toppling of the government. Senior Bush administration officials are scheduled to meet tomorrow at the White House to discuss the future of Iran, which has been accused of housing al-Qaeda leaders who played a part in the Saudi Arabian car bombings. The Guardian of London reports the British government opposes any move toward regime change in Iran. The Bush administration is reportedly pressing the International Atomic Energy Agency to issue a critical report next month on Iran's nuclear activities. The Pentagon plan may involve the Iraq-based armed opposition movement Mojahideen Khalq, even though it is designated a terrorist group by the State Department. This news from Afghanistan. Some 200 people threw rocks and cement at the U.S. Embassy this weekend and attacked international peacekeepers in a protest sparked by the killing of three Afghan soldiers last week by U.S. Marines. The Marines mistook the Afghans for enemy combatants and opened fire. The Washington Post is revealing that the New York Times top reporter on bioterrorism, Judith Miller, acknowledged to her colleagues that her main source for many of her articles has been Ahmed Chalabi, the controversial exile leader who is close to top Pentagon officials. In a column in today's paper, Washington Post media critic Howard Kurtz asks, could Chalabi have been using the Times to build a drumbeat that Iraq was hiding weapons of mass destruction? Miller's reliance on Chalabi was revealed after the Post obtained email correspondence between Miller and the Times' Baghdad bureau chief, John Burns. Miller has drawn criticism for her reporting on the hunt for Iraqi weapons while she was embedded with the MET Alpha unit. In an April 21st front-page story, she reported that a leading Iraqi scientist claimed Iraq had destroyed chemical and biological weapons days before the war began. This according to the Alpha team. In that story, she acknowledged that military officials had delayed the publication of the article and that the text of the article was submitted for approval by the military. Since then, the Washington Post reports no evidence has surfaced to support these claims, and the Alpha team is preparing to leave Iraq without having found weapons of mass destruction. And in other news from Iraq, the U.S.-run Iraqi administration has canceled or suspended three oil contracts with Russian and Chinese firms signed by the ousted government of Saddam Hussein. The U.S.-appointed Iraqi oil minister, Thamir Ghadban, said on Saturday all pre-war contracts will be reevaluated and the new deals announced soon. And Indonesia's military said today it is stepping up attacks against Aceh separatist guerrillas a week after the start of its biggest offensive for a quarter of a century. This according to Agence France-Presse. Officials said last week that the Indonesian military is also preparing tented camps to house up to 60,000 civilians who might be moved or relocated out of combat zones. And this news just in. An airplane carrying 62 Spanish peacekeeping troops returning from Afghanistan has crashed into a mountain in Turkey. The plane was attempting to land in thick fog. All 74 people aboard were killed. I was born by the river.
in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around.
Change is going to come, Sam Cooke, in response to a listener request on our website at www.democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, we premiered the controversial film, Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death. Today, part two, a discussion with the filmmaker. This is a film that has already been broadcast on national television in Britain, Germany, Italy, and Australia. Parts have been screened by the European Parliament, but until we broadcast the film last Friday, it had not been shown nationally in the United States. Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death, provides eyewitness testimony that U.S. troops were complicit in the massacre of thousands of Taliban prisoners during the Afghan War. The film tells the story of thousands of prisoners who surrendered to the U.S. military's Afghan allies after the siege of Kunduz. According to eyewitnesses, some 3,000 of the prisoners were forced into sealed containers and loaded onto trucks for transport to Shebrakhan prison. Witnesses say, when the prisoners began shouting for air, the U.S. allied Afghan soldiers fired directly into the trucks, killing many of them. The rest suffered through an appalling road trip lasting up to 4 days. So thirsty, they clawed at the skin of their fellow prisoners as they licked perspiration and even drank blood from open wounds. Eyewitnesses say when the trucks arrived and soldiers opened the containers, most of the people inside were dead. They also say U.S. Special Forces redirected the containers carrying the living and dead into the desert and stood by as survivors were shot and buried. Now up to 3,000 bodies lie buried in a mass grave. The film also provides footage of CIA officer Mike Spam interrogating American Taliban prisoner John Walker Lynn just hours before Spam was killed in the famous prison uprising of Mazar-e Sharif. The film has outraged human rights groups and international human rights lawyers who are calling for an investigation into whether U.S. Special Forces are guilty of war crimes. Today, part two of our series. In a minute, we speak to the film's director and producer, Jamie Duran. But first, we play an excerpt of the film. This is how it begins.
After the bloodiest battle of the entire Afghan war, 8,000 Taliban soldiers surrendered to the Northern Alliance and U.S. Special Forces under guarantee that their lives would be spared. Today, up to 3,000 of those men lie in an unmarked desert grave. And American soldiers stand accused by numerous eyewitnesses of being involved in their disappearance.
I think the scale of it, if you talk about thousands of bodies and a cover-up of those bodies, is comparable to thousands of bodies in New York. Now, that is very striking to me. And that's why I think this one will not go away.
An excerpt of Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death. We're joined right now by Jamie Duran, the award-winning filmmaker who's worked in the highest levels of television film production for more than two decades. His films have been broadcast everywhere around the world, virtually every major channel. On average, each of his films has been seen in around 35 countries. This film did not get the same attention, at least in this country. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, on Friday, we played the documentary, and we got tremendous response to it. Today, we want to play excerpts and talk to you. Lay out the thesis of the film as you start to do in the beginning that we just played.
Well, effectively, what happened was that 8,000 prisoners, Kunduz was under siege at the time from Northern Alliance soldiers and their American allies. And 8,000 soldiers surrendered after heavy negotiations between the Northern Alliance and the Taliban, but those negotiations actually included American and British military personnel. These negotiations actually took place at Kalajangi, where John Walker Lind had been held, the American Taliban. And the agreement took place whereby if they surrendered, their lives would be spared. That was absolutely straightforward. The majority were expected to be handed over to the United Nations. Instead, of course, there was, if you like, a subplot to this, and quite an essential one militarily, and I can understand it, and that was that the Americans needed to identify who was actually surrendering. Were they Taliban? Were they Al-Qaeda? And the decision was taken to effectively ship these prisoners to a place called Shebahan Prison, far to the west of Mazar-e-Sharif. Now, initially, about 470-odd, including John Walker Lind, broke off and went to Mazar, where that famous battle took place, which I'm sure everyone has seen. What I found terribly unfortunate, and one of the reasons I became involved, was that no one seemed to ask. The international press were completely obsessed with this battle at Kalajangi near Mazar, and no one seemed to bother asking, so what happened to the other 7,500? And this became effectively my task, to find out what happened there. I was drawn to it by speaking to two different groups of soldiers, one of General Dostum, who was America's greatest ally during the war, and the others of Muhammad Atta, who is one of the controllers around Mazar-e-Sharif. Both groups told me separately stories of American soldiers breaking the necks of Taliban prisoners. Now, I obviously found this an interesting suggestion, particularly when it came from two different groupings. Anyone who understands Afghanistan at all, and I'm sure many of your listeners will understand that, you know, Uzbeks do not exactly go out to dinner with Hazaras, who would rather kill Pashtun before they had, tea with the Tajiks. And so the strength of my witnesses in this film very much depends on the ethnicity of it all, the different ethnic backgrounds. James C. Hathaway, the professor of law at International Law at the University of Michigan, praised the film recently, talking of the difference in the kind of military and civilian background of my witnesses. What he didn't get into, which adds, of course, far greater force, is the ethnic background. These men come from all different regions and different ethnic groups. And they told me the story of how these prisoners, these prisoners were transported initially by truck to a place called Kali Zaini, which is just on the outskirts of Mazar. This was a kind of holding depot where they were then taken off the trucks, and these were open-back trucks at first. And then initially, after more trucks were brought in, the first ones, the lucky ones, were then taken on to Shebahan Prison. Now, you have to understand this was a prison built to hold between 500 and 600 at most. And by the time 3,000 had arrived, obviously, the prison was rather full. But also at that time, the news had come through from Kalajangi about the great battle. This is the Mazar battle. And Dostum had lost a good number of his generals and quite a good number of his men. And revenge was in the air. So effectively, the last if you like. Now, remember, I've always said only up to 3,000. And normally I've said between 1,500 and 3,000. Even the UN privately will agree that it's 2,000 to 2,500 in the graves that I discovered alone. But normally up to 3,000, between 1,500 and 3,000 is my call. It could actually be more than that, because 4,500 effectively are actually missing. What happened to them, some of them, several hundreds, were handed over to the security services of the various governments. They were actually sold. It's a great Afghan tradition, Afghan warlord tradition, where, you know, if you like, Uzbeks were sold back to the very feared SNB security police in Uzbekistan. The Chechens were handed over to the Russians, etc., etc. But even taking into those numbers, which I believe may go to several hundreds, we're still talking around 3,500 or more people who were then put into these containers. Containers brought in 25 in total at the time, I understand. They were crammed 200 to 300 at a time into the containers. The doors were then sealed. The men had no air at all, and were then they then began this journey from Khalil Zaini to Shebahan. It's a distance of only 120 kilometers, but in some cases that journey took up to 4 days because of the queue at Shebahan prison, because the American soldiers who had established a presence there, special forces, they'd established a presence there, and CIA, I should add, they'd established a presence there to identify the prisoners, and thus those in the containers who were stuck outside Shebahan had to wait. And as you know, as you've given us in your intro, when they'd cried out for air, there was a simple answer from the Northern Alliance soldiers, including one of my witnesses who admits himself to firing Kalashnikov into the sides of the containers, killing those nearest the sides in order to, you know, this kind of bizarre humanitarian effort to give them air. It was a pretty shocking story.
We're talking to Jamie Duran. He is the filmmaker who produced Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. And we'll come back with him as well as excerpts of his film after this break. Stay with us.
I'm just an American boy, raised on MTV, and I've seen all the kids in the soda pop bands, but none of them look like me. So I started looking around for a light out of the dim. And the first thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad, peace be upon him. I shouldn't if my daddy could see me now. Chains around my feet, he don't understand that sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes. And I believe God is great.
John Walker's Blues here on Democracy Now!, that by Steve Earle. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're going to talk about John Walker Lynn and Johnny Spann in a minute. Some amazing footage that I don't think has been shown in this country of the two at Mazar-e Sharif. But before we do that, we are going to play another excerpt of Jamie Duran's film, Afghan Massacre, the Convoy of Death, talking about the prisoners who had given themselves up, who are now being transported in trucks to Shebahan prison.
In a coordinated operation, truck drivers from all over the region had their vehicles commandeered by armed soldiers. Containers were loaded onto the back of the flatbeds and the drivers compelled to take their vehicles to Khalil Zaini.
We were coming in from Mazar when they seized our trucks for free and took us to Khalil Zaini, where there were already a lot of trucks. At about 2 a.m., they loaded our trucks with the prisoners. We were to the north of Kalezaini, where we loaded the trucks.
Originally loaded onto trucks at Kunduz, many of these men were crammed 200 to 300 at a time into the backs of sealed containers. After around 20 minutes, the prisoners began crying out for air.
The weather was very hot. They put too many people inside the containers. Many died because there was no air.
Another eyewitness has asked how many containers were at Kalezaini when he left.
There were about 25 containers. The condition of them was very bad because the prisoners couldn't breathe. So they shot into the containers and some of them were killed.
Another eyewitness.
They told us to stop the trucks and we came down. After that, they shot into the containers. Blood came pouring out of the containers. They were screaming
inside. One Afghan soldier admits that he personally murdered prisoners.
I hit the containers with bullets to make holes for ventilation, and some of them were killed.
You specifically shot holes into the containers. Who gave you those orders?
My commanders ordered me to hit the containers for ventilation, and because of that, some prisoners died.
But this was no humanitarian gesture. Rather than shooting into the roofs of the containers, the soldiers fired at random, killing those nearest the walls. A local taxi driver had called in at a petrol station on the road to Shibarhan.
I smelled something strange and asked the attendant where the smell was coming from. He said, "Look behind you." There were three trucks with containers fixed on them. Blood was running from the containers. My hair stood on end. It was horrific.
Whether or not the prisoners in the containers were ever really destined to reach Shibarhan must be open to question.
Jamie Duran narrating his film Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. Here on Democracy Now, joined by Jamie Duran on the telephone from Britain. And Jamie, as we listen to this horrific account, I'm looking at a Newsweek piece that was published last August, August 26th, and it says, witness reports and the probing of a mass grave point to war crimes. Does the United States have any responsibility for the atrocities of its allies? A Newsweek investigation. And this came just after you aired excerpts of this documentary for the European Parliament. It says, trudging over the moonscape of Dasht-e Layli, a desolate expanse of low-rolling hills in northern Afghanistan, Bill Haglund spotted clues half buried in the gray-beige sand, strings of prayer beads, a woolen skullcap, a few shoes. Those remnants, along with track marks and blade scrapes left by a bulldozer, suggested that Haglund had found what he was looking for. Then he came across a human tibia, three sets of pelvic bones, and some ribs. It says mass graves are not always easy to spot, though trained investigators know the signs. Says Haglund, a forensic anthropologist and pioneer in the field of human rights archaeology, you look for disturbance of the earth, differences in the vegetation, areas that have been machined over. The piece goes on from there and talks about how many are buried at Dashti Laili, and it says the dead at Dashti Laili and the horrific manner of their killing are one of the dirty little secrets of the Afghan war. The episode is more than just another atrocity in a land that has seen many. The killings illustrate the problems America will face if it opts to fight wars by proxy, as the United States did in Afghanistan, using small numbers of U.S. special forces, calling in air power to support local fighters on the ground. It also raises questions about the responsibility Americans have for the conduct of allies who may have no interest in applying protections of the Geneva Conventions. And then in the next paragraph, it says, nothing that Newsweek learned suggests that American forces had advanced knowledge of the killings, witnessed the prisoners being stuffed into the unventilated trucks, or were in a position to prevent that. They were in the area of the prison at the time the containers were delivered, although probably not when they were opened. It says the small group of security forces soldiers were more focused at the time on prison security and preventing an uprising, such as the bloody outbreak that had happened days earlier in the prison at Kalajangi. Your response?
Well, I mean, my response would take most of your program and most of your day. Frankly, the Newsweek piece was a whitewash of the worst degree, as indeed if you speak privately, perhaps to some of the authors you might discover. I honestly, Amy, don't know where to start. You should know that Newsweek, after my showing of a short clip of my film at the European Parliament, Newsweek approached me, and Roy Gutman indeed admitted at a meeting at the American University in Washington in January, in front of 300-400 people, whatever, I can't remember, he admitted that Newsweek's initial interest in the story had been brought about because of my showing of the film at the European Parliament. They then came and interviewed me at length, went off, did their own investigation, and came back and actually called me in the week before publication for my final quotes. Strangely, when the piece actually appeared, no mention of myself, which doesn't matter, I have a big enough ego anyway, no mention of our research, but strangely, if you take a look carefully at the Newsweek article, it seems to be two stories. It has a beginning, no middle, but an end. And I wonder, and I've always wondered, what was in the middle. I think, basically, the idea of any publication suggesting that American forces were not directly involved is not just nonsense, but it's an insult to the incredibly brave witnesses who came forward in my film. Now, maybe Newsweek weren't able to do this. I don't know the caliber of their journalists, frankly. Maybe they weren't able to find these witnesses. What I found fascinating was that after the meeting in Washington, Roy Gutman, having admitted that they began the film only because, or began their story only because of my film, and having tried to defend Newsweek's position, then called me up and said, Jamie, I didn't realize how much information you have. Can I get a copy of the film? To which I abruptly, you can understand, said no. I'd seen Newsweek's treatments already. You have to understand, and I'm sure you'll be bringing this up, two of these incredibly brave men, these witnesses in my film, have already been murdered by General Dostum's people. General Dostum, remember, was America's greatest ally during the war. To insult these men's memory by suggesting the Americans were not just involved, but also in command and control at Shebarhan prison for the very purpose of identifying Al-Qaeda and Taliban is beyond understanding. You can probably hear a little shake in my voice. It's a shake of anger that people could actually go ahead and publish such an article and not do a proper, thorough investigation. The Pentagon knows that its people were involved. The State Department knows that the military were involved. They tried everything they could to damn me. And incidentally, the film has been seen in well over 20, maybe as many as 30 countries now. It was offered to many stations in the U.S. who rejected it. Now, remember, I know, I'm pretty long in the tooth, and I know many of the guys, many of the people involved in American television. And the answer I was effectively getting was, not now, Jamie. You know, it's kind of post 9/11, pre-Iraq, post-Iraq. It's all this thing. It's control of another kind coming out of the Pentagon. Again, perhaps an interesting aside is that a journalist tried to follow this up an American journalist who's quite frequently published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, etc., etc. And she found it strange that no one seemed to want to cover this story. So she called up Larry Schwartz at the State Department. I'm sure most of your listeners know and have seen Larry Schwartz on many occasions. And she said to him, you know, Larry, I can't understand why, you know, there's a couple of small newspapers taking this story, but why won't the majors? Why won't the nationals? And Larry said, and I quote directly, "You have to understand we're involved, we're in touch with the nationals on a daily basis. This story just won't run, even if it's true." Now, that seems to me the most clear comment on the freedom of the American media at the moment.
We're talking to Jamie Duran. His film is Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. We thought we'd play another excerpt of your film. The part where you talk about U.S. military involvement, which, of course, is throughout the documentary. This one emphasizes it. We're playing excerpts of the film that we premiered on Friday so that we can talk about it piece by piece. Extraordinary allegations of the film team. And in a little while, we're also going to talk about the Afghan researcher who worked with you and what happened to him as he tried to get the final videotapes. This is another excerpt of Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death.
If American soldiers were involved in covering up their role at Sheberhan Prison, it would border on war crimes. If they stood by as the summary execution of prisoners took place when they could have intervened, this would be positively criminal. But could the United States argue they were not in a responsible position?
They would not have taken orders from Afghans. They would have been in charge of security there, therefore it is an American command, therefore it is ultimately an American responsibility for whatever went on under the eyes of those American soldiers.
That was analyst Robert Fox.
It's quite clear that because you have film evidence of a mass grave, people confessing that the relevant authorities, be they American, Afghani, or international, must carry out an investigation. You have identified the site of a mass grave. You've identified bodies in those graves, and it's quite clear again that pathologists, forensic pathologists, exhuming the bodies, could identify the cause of death, and I think very importantly, could identify who these people are, because their families had a right to know. They have been disappeared involuntarily after being murdered.
Lawyer Andrew McEntee.
Late September 2002, just over a year after the murder of over 3,000 Americans by Al-Qaeda, human rights expert Andrew McEntee arrives at the scene of another massacre, this time said to involve U.S. special forces.
Well, I understand from very good sources in international organizations, together with the witnesses, that we're certainly talking at 2,000 upwards here, 2,000 to 2,500 in this area.
Is this from a reliable source, an official source?
Yes, I'm not at liberty to say who, but I can tell you it's a very reliable source, which has not yet gone public.
The grave covers an area well in excess of 1,000 square metres.
Everything I've seen here is consistent with testimonies I've heard and read. There seems to be a large area where there's at least... There are several pits here which clearly have bodies in them, clothing. Bullets are consistent with shootings beside the graves. And there are bullets all over the place, cases of bullets. And somebody's been a bit clumsy in removing the evidence. The Americans couldn't have been kept out of the fact there was a major industrial operation with the excavation going on here and containers coming in, the area closed off for a couple of days. They couldn't have been kept out of that. Having effective command and control does mean they were senior in the chain of command. With knowledge, or presuming they had knowledge of what was going on, yes, they had a responsibility to stop it.
General Dostum has said recently that he would agree to an international investigation. But there's a small problem. He says he can't guarantee the safety of those involved.
We have...
That was General Dostum being referred to by Jamie Duran in this film, Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. Tell us a little more about the Afghan general and his relationship with the U.S. Special Forces, Jamie.
Well, I mean, Dostum is a fascinating character. I met him on quite a number of occasions. I think I managed to conduct the only sit-down televised interviews with him because he was always on the move. I was actually with him as we were kind of charging into Taliban villages in a clear-up operation. He is a fascinating character. He's a very large man, physically a very large man. And indeed, speaking to him, I think I remember my first question, which I didn't know if I would get an answer or I'd be, you know, 6 feet under, was, General Dostum, you're known throughout the Western world as a cold-blooded mass murderer. Do you think that's fair? It was fairly direct, but the man is a very strong character and indeed answered it in the end, basically saying that, you know, people can say what they want, but my people know I'm a good guy. But it is Dostum's men who carried this out, and in terms of international criminal law, and I don't know about his direct involvement, but certainly I do know that his chief commander, a man known as the Lal Commander, was very much the man behind all of this, his chief military commander. The Americans saw Dostum. I think Richard Pearl in the film says we'd rather have had Mother Teresa, but effectively she wasn't available, so we settled for General Dostum. Dostum is known as a very, very violent character. He's a man who stood by as one of his own men was strapped to the tracks of a tank for disloyalty and apparently lectured him personally as the tank inched forward. He's also a man who has apparently boasted about biting the throats out of four different men. This was the man that America chose to make its ally, its chief ally during the war. He is a brilliant military strategist, there's no question about it, and he was the man who, more than anyone else, caused the defeat of the Taliban. I was in the Kokchar region with Fahim's Northern Alliance at the time, and they were actually sitting, waiting, and I was told by the local commander, a man known as Mamur Hassan, that everyone is waiting for Dostum to take Mazar. When Dostum takes Mazar, the Taliban will be so frightened of him moving forward, they will cave in. And indeed, that's exactly what they did.
Jamie, we have to break. We'll come back with you describing the footage you air of Johnny Spann and John Walker Lynn that I think was shocking to many people who got to watch and hear this past Friday. And then we're going to talk about the Afghan researcher who tried to get the final videotape and what would be Dostum's interest in having these videotapes made of these horrific war crimes that he is deeply involved with, why he's having them documented. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're talking with Jamie Duran, the filmmaker who did Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. Stay with us.
Chains around my feet. You don't understand. Sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes. And I believe God is great. All praise due to him. And if I should die, I rise up to the sky just like Jesus. Peace be upon him. I shall do la ila, ila, ila. There's no God but God.
The controversial song John Walker's Blues by Steve Earle here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the film Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. The next excerpt we're going to play, you hear CIA officer Mike Spann interrogating the American Taliban prisoner John Walker Lynn shortly before Spann was killed in the famous prison uprising. Now, it is not easy to hear. This is video. It's a little easier, perhaps, to hear there. Lin is kneeling on the ground with his arms tied behind his back. Two CIA officers are standing right in front of him. The CIA agents are saying to each other, the problem is he needs to decide if he wants to live or die. I mean, if he don't want to die here, he's going to die here because we're just going to leave him and he's going to stay in prison for the rest of his life. Short life. It's his decision. We can only help those guys who want to talk to us. We can only get the Red Cross to help so many guys. That's within this excerpt of Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death.
Kalai Jungi, a giant mud brick fort on the outskirts of Mazar, which Dostum made his military headquarters after capturing the city. A section of the main building was made available to American Special Forces and CIA personnel who had arrived to interrogate the prisoners.
These men are dead. These men are dead.
The Taliban were housed in this block before being taken out one by one and made to sit in long lines across the fort interior, their arms tied behind their backs. Chechens, Arabs, Pakistanis, and Uzbeks. Only a few were Afghans. Amongst the prisoners was John Walker Lind, the American Taliban, who attempted to conceal his identity from two CIA officers.
Well, obviously it is. The problem is he needs to decide if he wants to live or die, and die here. I mean, if he don't want to die here, he's going to die here, because this is where we're just going to leave, and they're going to put him in prison the rest of his fucking life. You know, short life. It's his decision, man. We can only help those guys who want to talk to us. We can only get the Red Cross to help so many guys. If they don't talk to us, we can't.
We can't. Just an hour or so after these pictures were taken, one of them, Mike Spern, would be dead following an uprising amongst the prisoners.
That another excerpt from Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. Jamie Duran, filmmaker, can you describe this footage and how you got it? The only footage that I remember seeing of John Walker Lin was the picture of him laying with his face darkened.
Yeah, basically I got this footage by paying dollars. That's the bottom line. There was a fascination in northern Afghanistan around that time and probably since, of people, you know, you have to understand this nation had very few modern things. And one of the real fascinations came around video cameras. And this particular one, I think, was shot on an old VHS camera. And basically, I paid some dollars. What actually happened was that the cameraman had managed to get inside the compound. This is prior to the riots, to the revolt. And he got inside the compound and was filming. I'm certain didn't have a single clue as to what the CIA fellows were actually saying to Lind, but you know, managed to actually just pick up this footage, which we then managed to decipher and play out. It was just one of the fascinating things is that, of course, as a result of our film going out in the European Parliament, I was then approached by Lind's own personal investigators, who came over to see me in London. Now, they were obviously fighting to defend Lind. And he then headed over to Afghanistan and came back to see me on the way back. And he'd gone to film Lind's exact position in the hills, certain hills, as I'll explain. And he showed me the footage showing how, you know, and Lind's main defense at the time was that he, although he'd carried a rifle or a gun, he'd never ever fired it, nor had he seen any activity whatsoever, any violent or warlike activity of any kind. At which point I then asked my cameraman from who was with me in Afghanistan to come back into the room where I was viewing this. And I didn't say a word, and I just asked Barry, Lin's investigator, to run the footage back and let us see it again and let Mark, my cameraman, see it. And Mark watched it and then said, and I think I can, I'll keep my words fairly gentle, avoiding the expletives, by saying, good Lord, that's where they were shooting at us from. This was John Walker Lind's exact position. 4 days later, Lind agreed a plea bargain with the U.S.
Say that one more time.
4 days after, Barry had come to us and we had identified that that was where we were being shot upon. We were actually in the trenches below Lind's position. And indeed, Lind effectively was lying. He had actually been involved in an area of fighting without any question. I'm not saying he fired the bullets, but to suggest that he'd not been involved at all was nonsense. 4 days after, Barry discovered that Lind had actually been, let's just say, not telling the full truth. They agreed a plea bargain with the U.S. government. That's when Lind got 20 years.
Dostum, who still has tens of thousands of dollars worth of your equipment, but to say the least, that's the least of what he has done. Can you talk about why you think he may be involved? And we're going to play a big excerpt of your researcher and what happened to him. Do you believe Dostum had the tapes made of the massacre to protect himself?
I think you have to understand that General Dostum, General Dostum has three cameramen who kind of shoot everything. They were shooting in the hills in the initial battles long before the full involvement. This was just after the American Special Forces had joined up with him. You know, I have footage of Dostum in the hills with the U.S. Special Forces actually beginning the campaign against the Taliban. Why does he have this particular footage? His cameraman shoots everything in sight. Two, it's the best insurance policy I could possibly imagine because, let's face it, if Dostum is accused of war crimes, he will then be able to show this footage and say, but hang on, it wasn't just me. There were other people there. For instance, here's some footage of American Special Forces standing by as men are massacred.
Well, let's go to the excerpt of the documentary where you describe what happened to your researcher, the award-winning journalist Najibullah Qureshi, who is Afghan, as he tried to get the last video documentary evidence of the massacre site. This is Afghan Massacre Convoy of Death.
Security in northern Afghanistan is a virtually impossible concept to grasp, particularly when you're investigating the very people who hold all the cards. Our local researcher, Najibullah Qureshi, had managed to access damning footage of events at Kali Zaini, Shibar Khan, and Dashti Laili. He had been shown a tape of 1.5 hours in length, which included film of Dostum's soldiers shooting into the containers, American personnel surrounding those same containers as the bodies were dragged off at Shibar Khan, and crucially, pictures of the summary executions at Dashti Laili, with U.S. Special Forces standing by, doing nothing to intervene. A price was agreed, and Najibullah left Mazar for the handover. We could only wait. As the day wore on, we became concerned.
I had taken a VCR with me to copy the film. I rewound it to the beginning and started making the copy. I only managed to record 1.5 minutes during the time on the film when they were loading the Taliban onto the containers. They were opening and loading them onto containers, and then they started shooting into the containers. Just then, a fat man entered the room. There were three people, one of whom was armed. The person who was giving me the film told me, quote, "This is my brother." His brother swore at him and said he told him not to give the film to anyone. Quote, "Why have you given him the film?" he asked. Then they started beating us. They hit my head a lot at the beginning. After that, I fell unconscious.
Drifting in and out of consciousness, he remembers being driven in a car, his captors apparently planning to dispose of his body.
One of them was saying, quote, "There's a well around here." They stopped the car and took me out. Then another car arrived, but they started beating me again. After that, I don't know what happened. I woke up and I was home.
Although nothing can be certain, it appears that the people in the other car knew Najibullah and managed to save his life, despite his captors giving him a final beating.
There was some very interesting and dangerous footage on the film.
Could this film be General Dostum's insurance policy? Could he be saying, if I get accused of war crimes, then I'll bring down the Americans with me?
What evidence did you see in the film of American involvement?
I saw lots of them at Sherbaghan prison. We can see it on the footage, Americans at Sherbaghan prison. You can see them standing by when they open the containers. There's a lot of footage of them. You can also see a few of them at Dasht Laili.
For 8 days, Najibullah remained under armed guards we provided at a safe house far from Mazar until he was ready to travel.
The winner of the 2002 Rory Peck Award for Hard News is Najibullah Kiroshan.
And after recuperation in London lasting over a month, his bravery was recognized with a major award for work contained in this film.
I wish a safe and prosperous life for all the journalists in the world, without interference in their profession. And also, I would like to dedicate this award to the people of Afghanistan, my lovely country.
But without an independent inquiry into the events in northern Afghanistan, that bravery will have been wasted.
Najibullah Qureshi accepting one of the highest awards in journalism, the Afghan researcher who tried to get the videotapes, which brings us to the end of this conversation. Jamie Moran, two quick questions. One is why the U.S. media outside of Democracy Now! On Friday has not broadcast this documentary. Did you try?
If I can maybe say very, very quickly, of course, we tried to get many people to take it. And as you know, the state of the mood in America just now is very strange and rather frightening. I should tell you also that just a number of weeks ago, I was down on the Afghan border. This is not known by anyone, but I shall tell you now because it's too late. I was down on the Afghan border to actually pick up a copy of the film in question. There are actually a number of copies around now. The man died 4 weeks ago. He was captured on the way over to meet me. I'd actually followed his instructions. I also had $50,000, I don't mind saying, in my pocket. I'd wanted him to go south to Pakistan. He insisted on coming north. Our communications had been done at the highest level. I brought my own security person in to try and ascertain how he could have been caught, how this could have happened, because they were waiting for him.
We have 30
and his
seconds.
His answer was, it could only have been done, arranged by a nation state.
Well, and you are saying?
I'm saying that America were involved.
Well, I want to thank
you. That was the implication very clearly from my own security experts.
And the Pentagon continues to deny your allegations.
But Pentagon have tried everything. They denied the entire thing to begin with, then admitted this, and finally admitted that. And effectively, it broke down to the Pentagon having, you know, at least 50 and anything up to maybe 75, 100 plus special forces soldiers there walking about with blindfolds on for 10 days. That's if you accept the Pentagon's way. And let me tell you the one hope I have. I know many, many American Special Forces soldiers. These are extremely brave, brave
5 seconds.
They will have been disgusted by what they saw, and they themselves will come forward.
Jamie Duran, filmmaker, author, produced the film Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. That does it for the show. Our website is democracynow.org. The show is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Andrew Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdelkadous, Elizabeth Press, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman.